Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
The title, you can see on the poster, starts off West versus East, which makes it sound a bit like a boxing competition or something. West versus East. Will we get a winner tonight? I can't say. You'll have to decide for yourself who's won this particular battle. But then we've got the subtitle. Is Thomas Aquinas or Thomism? I noticed on the poster it's Thomism. Might be a slight difference. Is Thomas compatible with orthodoxy? Is Thomism compatible with orthodoxy? I'll get to that in the end, because there is a distinction between the person and teaching of Thomas Aquinas and the later philosophical theological systems that go by the name of Thomism. So we'll try and answer this question. Is Thomism compatible with orthodoxy within an overarching East versus West framework, theologically, ecclesiologically speaking? So many people, if you would ask them, is the theology of Thomas Aquinas compatible with the theology of the Orthodox Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church? Most people, I think, would probably say no. They wouldn't expect Thomas to have much to do with the Orthodox Church, the Orthodox Christian Church of the East. On both sides, on both the Latin side, Western side, and the Greek Eastern side, we have a very long inherited tradition on both sides as regarding the other as wholly different, that there's some sort of primal division within Christianity between Greek East and Latin West, what become later the churches of the West, Protestant and Catholic, and then the Orthodox Church in the East. I have to say, sadly, from an Orthodox point of view, you find very widespread the idea that Orthodoxy alone possesses the truth and there's no grace outside the Orthodox Church. Catholics, Protestants, bad as each other, and both devoid of sacraments, devoid of grace, you know, an extreme position which I'm not in any sympathy with myself. From the Reformer's point of view, you'll see denigration, certainly, of Orthodox theology from a Western point of view. And even where Orthodox theology isn't being written off as just sort of mystical or Eastern or foreign, there can be a tendency in Western theology not to really take it seriously. You know, the only real serious Christianity is either Catholic or Protestant, and the only real debates within Christianity are between Catholics and Protestants, so leaving the East out of the equation altogether. Then even in, you know, the intellectual circles of the Thomist tradition, as opposed to Thomas himself, there has been a bit of a tradition, yes, of regarding the East as rather weird, rather strange, lots of peculiar ideas. And I've got enormous respect and love for the founder of the Thomistic Institute, Father Thomas Joseph White. And in fact, we were in a Greek class together years ago in Oxford. And I've debated with him quite a bit about his recent book on the Trinity, and we had a bit of a conference in Rome on his book on the Trinity. And at one point, I was sort of gently, at least for me, gently criticizing his understanding of Thomism as a sort of perfect and complete system which explains everything and doesn't really need anything else, doesn't really need the Christian East. Yes, there may be some interesting people in the East, so on and so forth, let's dialogue with them, but Thomism basically as an all-sufficient system in and of itself. And I think that's definitely been a strand in modern Thomism, let's say, going back to the period of the papal encyclical Aeterni Patris in 1879, which laid down Thomas and Thomism as a kind of philosophical basis for Catholic Christianity and its encounter with the modern world, producing the Thomism of people like Reginald Garrigou Lagrange. And I would say, Father Thomas Joseph White, anyway, I was gently teasing him at one point, talking about his recent book on the Trinity as being, how did I put it, the implacable progress and relentless perfection of the Thomist machine. So So you have a kind of juggernaut, and all the other points of view, Orthodox or Protestant or whatever they might be, even errant Catholic points of view, just sort of falling by the wayside with the implacable progress and relentless perfection of the Thomist machine. Anyway, he loved it. I meant it as a bit of a criticism, but he said, that's fantastic, that's exactly what I want, and I want to get a bumper sticker with the with the implacable progress and relentless perfection of the Thomist machine. But with all due love and admiration of a formidable intellect, it does seem to me that some forms of modern Thomism can be a little too all-sufficient and not really need orthodoxy. So in other words, setting up this West-East debate and the question of whether Thomas specifically, or Thomism, compatible with orthodoxy, I think we need to recognise that on both sides there can be a problem. There can be orthodox dismissals of Western theology, Western dismissals, or not really taking seriously orthodox theology. So these are, you know, framing questions for our debate today. And of course, it's become quite natural to speak about East and West as clear theological categories. And I think any of us who are involved in theology or even church life in any serious way kind of tend to assume there's a bit of a disjunct between Christian East and Christian West, hence the East versus West we had on the poster. I don't know if many of you know the English poet Rudyard Kipling, but one of his famous poems declares that East is East and West is West, and never the twain shall meet, never the twain shall meet. And that quote is actually quite useful for encapsulating prevailing attitudes on both sides of the spectrum, East and West. East is East and West is West, and never the twain shall meet. Now, it has to be said that Orthodox theology in the 20th century, so don't let me give you the impression that I'm only going to criticize Western theology. I also want to do some self-criticism of Orthodox theology. Orthodox theology in the 20th century has been a bit too prone to dealing in this East-West dichotomy, that you have, say, the West, which is characterized as rationalistic, legalistic, interested in power, whereas the East is very mystical, very liturgical, very lovely, all the nice things, West is all the bad things. And so Orthodox theologians have been quite happy to perpetuate that kind of narrative, a nasty, legalistic, rationalistic West versus a lovely, mystical, liturgical Christian East. But I think there's a real cost involved in defining orthodoxy in opposition. So not Western, not Catholic, not Protestant. I mean, orthodoxy's really got to be defined for what it is, not for what it's not. So this kind of dialectical construct of identity vis-a-vis a foreign other, defining yourself by what you're not, is, I think, a very negative tendency in a lot of 20th century Orthodox theology, and I'll be talking about some examples of that in what follows. It seems to me to do a disservice to the Orthodox tradition. Anyhow, that much by way of introduction. So I have two main parts to this paper. Firstly, I'm going to talk a little bit about how it is that theologians in Greek East and Latin West have come to think in more or less rigid terms of East and West, with Thomas invariably as the supreme representative of Western theology, rationalistic, scholastic, legalistic, etc. How do we get to this point, especially in the Orthodox context? Secondly, I'm going to look back, so comparing the 20th century, where this narrative of clear dichotomy or opposition between East and West had really set in, but compare that to the later Roman or Byzantine period. I mean, what did the Greeks think when they first read Aquinas, when he was first translated into Greek in the 14th century? And you may perhaps even be surprised to know that in the late Roman or Byzantine Empire, centered on Constantinople, they were reading contemporary Latin authors. They were translating Aquinas. The Summa Contra Gentiles, for example, was translated in 1354. So the last 100 years of the Roman Empire in the East, they're reading, debating Aquinas. And incidentally, the Western people are not reading the Eastern writers with anything like the same enthusiasm. So there's sort of two main poles to this paper. 20th century, a lot of anti-Western stuff in Orthodox theology. 14th, 15th century, a much more subtle, constructive, but appropriately critical where necessary, approach to Western theology. So that's what we're doing tonight. So we talk about East and West. And of course, East and West are primarily geographical denominators. Specifically, they talk about the direction in which the sun rises and the sun sets from a European perspective, from a Roman perspective. The Emperor Diocletian, at the end of the 3rd century, divided the empire into two halves, East and West. The West, more or less Latin-speaking, in terms of the language of common communication, and the East, more or less Greek-speaking. And that actually, that division in the 3rd century was remarkably enduring. Even if you look at the dividing line between Catholic Europe and Orthodox Europe, you know, more or less follows Diocletian's line on the map. But as I say, East and West, it's primarily a geographic indicator. And if you look at the early church, so the period of what we often call the undivided church, you know, broadly speaking, the first millennium, nobody, I would say, had any idea that just because you write in Latin or just because you write in Greek, your theology is going to be different. If you look at Ambrose or Augustine in the West, or the Cappadocian Fathers, or St. John Chrysostom, or St. Maximus in the East, nobody supposes the East and West are anything more than just a geographical indicator. And the fact that you write in Latin no more creates a kind of separate theological tradition than if you write in Syriac, or Armenian, or Georgian, or Ethiopic. So the first 1,000 years, even right into the second millennium. So in the 14th century, there are a series of debates in Constantinople between representatives of the West, Dominicans and Franciscans in particular, and representatives of the Orthodox Church. So the main speaker for the Orthodox on this occasion, so this is 1339, Varlaam of Calabria. He's a Greek monk, but from southern Italy. He declares, in 1339, so recognizing there are disagreements between the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church, if we can use those terms, a little bit anachronistically, but differences between Greek East and Latin West, he declares, that which separates the Greeks from you Latins, not so much a difference in dogma, as the hatred of the Greeks for the Latins provoked by the wrongs they have suffered. So by this time, you're beginning to get in Orthodox Christian circles a sense of, you know, resentment against particularly the Fourth Crusade. The Fourth Crusade, which ended up occupying Constantinople between 1204 and 1261. You know, that was a scandalous and shameful episode in Christian history. Not that the Easterners were always very kind to the Westerners either. There was a massive massacre of the Latins in Constantinople in 1186. So this did go both ways. You notice I try and be pretty fair, pretty balanced. You can criticize me in questions if you don't think I'm being balanced enough. But yeah, there was a lot of bad blood on both sides between Latins and Greeks by the 13th century. But even then, people could say, we share the same theological tradition. We share the same fathers. We share the same scriptures. We share the same faith. And when we do use philosophy, like Thomas uses Aristotle, well, they're all using Aristotle in the Christian East too. You know, the commonalities are much stronger than the temporary disagreements. So even in the 14th century, a lot of bad blood on both sides, but as yet no suspicion that Greek East and Latin West are kind of separate worlds. Now, there's already a schism, of course, in place at this point, but this is seen as a kind of temporary aberration, something that we can get through, you know, if we have good faith and if we rely upon our common foundations in Scripture, in the fathers, and using a shared philosophical tradition to express the faith. So even amongst those who are at this time opposed to reuniting with Rome on grounds of question of papal primacy, addition of the filioque, the phrase, and the creed, and the son to the creed, these kind of questions, even those opposed to reunion with Rome, and it must be said that at the time Rome was asking quite a high price for reunion. So even those in the Eastern Empire who were opposing sort of rapprochement with the papacy, there's still this sense of a shared tradition. So I'll be speaking about some of these people who teach a kind of shared faith, even with the temporary difficulties which are going on in the late medieval, early modern period. Now, Perhaps that's surprising. As I say, many of us will be used to a 20th century model of dichotomy, and the Orthodox must always have realised the Catholics were completely wrong, and vice versa. But in fact, when you go back to the later Roman Empire, 14th, 15th century, you see a much more creative, subtle, constructive approach to Western theology. Anyhow, I want to tell you a little bit about how we got to this 20th century idea that East and West are opposites. So having established that no one thought East and West are kind of opposites until very recently, I mean, when did people start thinking East and West were kind of opposites? Well, the answer may surprise you, at least the answer I give and the answer I argue for, that it's not actually before the 19th century that we find that kind of attitude. So before that, yes, there are serious differences between East and West. There are different understandings of authority, particularly around the papacy, different understandings of purgatory, different understandings of Trinitarian theology, the filioque. But there isn't a conviction that East and West are fundamentally different and competing theological traditions. Not at all. It starts in the 19th century. And here we go back to the Russian world and the Russian Empire. And particularly, it seems to me, to the figure of Peter the Great. So Peter the Great in the early 18th century launches a great process of westernization in Russia, opening up ports in the Baltic, in the Black Sea, modeling Russia on Western European norms, forcing all the nobles to cut off their beards. Beards are seen a bit too primitive, and if you're going to be properly modern, you shouldn't have a beard. That's just kind of a symbolic representation. Anyway, Peter the Great has this big policy of westernization. Let's westernize Russia. Russia's future lies in ever closer engagement with the Western European world. Brief summary of Peter there. Of course, there's a bit of a backlash to Peter's westernization. And that backlash is associated with a theological movement called the Slavophiles, or the Lovers of the Slavs. So the Lovers of the Slavs were anti-Westernizers. They were opposed to Peter the Great's policy of, you know, looking westward. And they said, no, instead, you know, Russia's destiny, Russia's future shouldn't be following the model of Western Europe. It should be looking at its own native Slav traditions and its own Orthodox traditions, its own, the Greek fathers, the mystical, patristic, ascetic inheritance of the Eastern Church. And that's how we're going to resist this imperial tsarist policy of westernization, looking westward. And yet we're jolly well going to keep our beards. So the Slavophiles, they are the first ones to be really talking about East versus West. East versus West. So there's a total difference between the traditions of the Christian East and the traditions of the Christian West. So some of the Slavophiles, for example, a figure called Kirievsky, Ivan Kirievsky, in the early 19th century, characterizes Western theology by scholasticism, by rationalism, and sets up Thomas Aquinas as a very clear sort of apex figure in this very foreign theological tradition, which is characterized by far too much rationalism. So he talks about scholasticism as being an endless, tiresome juggling of concepts over 700 years, so going back to high medieval scholasticism, a useless kaleidoscope of abstract categories spinning unceasingly before the mind's eye. So Western scholasticism, typified by Aquinas, just represents the sort of theology we don't want in the Orthodox world. It's too rationalistic, it's too abstract, it doesn't get you anywhere. It's divorced from the real wellsprings of the faith, both scriptural and patristic. It's other. This is not us. And other figures in the Slavophile movement include Alexei Komiakov, 1804 to 1860. He's quite interesting because he spent a lot of time wandering around Western Europe and speaking to Western Christians. And he used to quite enjoy surprising Protestants and Catholics by telling them they were two sides of the same coin. That basically the West is one form of Christianity, either with a plus in front of it or a minus in front of it. So papacy, you know, yes amongst the Catholics, no amongst the Protestants, but they have basically the same understanding of the church. The Pope was the first Protestant. That was one of his lines. The Pope was the first Protestant. And I think he used to quite enjoy getting a rise out of Protestants and Catholics. So for him, Western theology is a whole. It's all too rationalistic. It's all too interested in questions divorced from the wellsprings of Christian life. So he opposed Western theology, whether Catholic or Protestant, to the Orthodox theological tradition, which was characterized by native Slav traditions of togetherness, conciliarity, subornost, togetherness, Catholicity with a small c, polar opposite to what we find in the West. Now, of course, it's an idealized vision of Slavic traditions, an idealized vision of Orthodoxy. But you see the same point. East and West clearly opposed theological, ecclesiological traditions. And as I say, that attitude doesn't go back further than the 19th century. You don't find it in earlier texts. Of course, you'll find plenty of Orthodox criticizing the West for papacy, filioque, and so forth, but they don't assume that these are fundamentally different traditions that can have nothing in common. They don't assume that East is East and West is West and never the twain shall meet, okay? This is new in the 19th century, and it comes out of a specific context within the Russian Empire of Peter the Great and his successors. And as I say, Aquinas is typically the archetypal figure of the rationalist, everything that's wrong with the West. Augustine gets a bit of a look into, and Anselm. So Augustine for the filioque, Anselm for his understanding of atonement. It's convenient that in this Orthodox narrative of opposition, all the bad guys in the Christian West begin with A. It's easy to remember. Augustine, Anselm, Aquinas. You could probably add Abelard there. I don't know any other people beginning with an A. But anyway, all the bad guys begin with A. They're all too rationalistic. They all probe too far into the divine mystery, and they all get things wrong. And the Orthodox Church maintains a certain purity and integrity precisely by keeping itself away from Western theology, whether Catholic or Protestant. So as I say, this is something new. Defining Orthodoxy for what it's not, and particularly as a species of anti-Westernism or anti-Thomism. This is a new dialectical oppositional construct of Orthodox identity, which is still very much with us today. And this Slavophile approach to theology bequeathed a powerful legacy. So much of the Orthodox theology of the 20th century has been dominated by this paradigm of opposition, East versus West. And here, one figure I want to put before you is the figure of Sergius Bulgakov, probably the greatest thinker in the Orthodox world in the 20th century, but somebody who was very much involved in this kind of paradigm of opposition between East and West, and specifically in this paradigm of opposition which sets up Thomas Aquinas as the archetypal Westerner. So he writes a long, awful lot of work, which I can't go into today, but he does write a piece on the Eucharistic theology. And for Bulgakov, briefly speaking, the doctrine of transubstantiation, with which Thomas Aquinas is indelibly associated, represents, in a nutshell, everything that's wrong with Western theology. It's over-defining the mystery of the universe. Why do you have to go into the mystery of the transformation of the elements of the bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ with all this language of substance and accidents and so forth? That's totally unnecessary. So for Bulgakov, this is going too much philosophy. It's theology. You know, philosophy is meant to be the handmaiden of theology. But this is the other way around. Theology is being directed, subsumed, distorted by philosophy. So Bulgakov, briefly, transubstantiation, Thomas Aquinas, that's the sort of exemplar image of everything that's wrong with Western theology. Too much philosophy, too much rationalism. And he even goes to say that even Protestant resistance to the doctrine of transubstantiation is just a kind of negative Thomism. So again, yes, the Catholics have transubstantiation, the Protestants have not transubstantiation, but they're both conditioned by the same sort of line of argument and the same sort of excessive rationalism. So again, we've got Protestants and Catholics as sort of two sides of the same coin. So for Bulgakov, major 20th century Orthodox theologian, Thomas represents the spirit of rationalism that has given rise to many of the problems, many of the ills of the modern world. And how are we going to get away from that? Well, going back to the church fathers, that's the only way out of what he calls the scholastic labyrinth. So if we want to be saved from too much rationalism, we need to simply go back to the fathers. And that language of return to the sources, return to the fathers, a dominant strand in 20th century Orthodox theology, as in 20th century Catholic theology, the theology of the Catholic ressourcement, or going back to the sources movement, associated with de Lubac and Balthasar and Danilou and other Catholic thinkers. So I hope it's clear that Bulgakov's very negative take on Thomas, wrapped up with the idea of the transfiguration, the doctrine of the transfiguration, teaching on the transfiguration, transubstantiation. I was talking about the transfiguration earlier. So Bulgakov's attack on transubstantiation, attack on Thomas, is very much conditioned by this Slavophile narrative of opposition. The East is too in awe of the mystery to start trying to work out what exactly is going on in the Eucharist. And it just shows how the West just can't stop going where it should not go. Theologians ought to know where to stop, and they should stop at how the body and blood are connected from the bread and the wine. That's not something that humans can ever satisfactorily determine. You see other very negative takes on Catholic theology, on Thomas, in other major Orthodox theologians of the 20th century. Here I'm just going to mention the figure of Vladimir Losky for a moment. So Losky was utterly opposed to Bulgakov on other theological grounds. But he too thought Thomas Aquinas represented everything that's wrong with the West, especially in terms of Trinitarian theology. So for Bulgakov, it's transubstantiation that shows everything that's wrong with Thomas and the West in general. For Losky, it's the doctrine of the Trinity, especially this idea of the filioque, Holy Spirit proceeding from the Father and the Son, confessed in both Catholic and Protestant West, of course. That's the sort of worst peak example of Western rationalism at its most unacceptable. And Losky was actually involved in with some of the great thinkers of the Thomist revival of the 20th century, people like Étienne Gilson. But that didn't stop him being very down on Thomas in general. And in fact, Losky goes on to say that the differing approaches to theology we see in Christian East and Christian West are so fundamental, that you can't even apply the same term theology to what's going on. So here we have an Orthodox theologian conditioned by this narrative of opposition, East versus West, going to the length of saying that we can't even call Western theology theology because it's so other, so strange, so different. So yeah, I think that's a very negative approach. Just one last 20th century theologian, George Florovsky, has, I think, a much more subtle, creative, constructive approach to Western theology. And he very consciously refuses this sort of East-West dichotomy and is very sympathetic to Augustine. He's able to read Anselm constructively. And for our purposes today, sees in Thomas and Thomism, indeed, a form of theology that does go back to the Greek fathers, to the Greek philosophical tradition. In other words, a form of theology that Orthodox can do business with, that there can be a creative understanding. So Florovsky is, I think, a very important theologian if we're trying to overcome this sort of narrative of dichotomy, opposition between East and West. Florovsky would treat Christian theology under the heading of Christian Hellenism. There he would talk about the kind of baptism of Plato, Aristotle, the Stoics, into a force for the articulation of Christian dogma that he thought was shared by East and West. So under the banner of Christian Hellenism, he wouldn't just include the Greek fathers, he'd include Latin fathers, Augustine, he'd include Aquinas. And he'll say quite specifically that Thomas and Thomism are surely Hellenistic. He appreciated the Greek dimension in Thomas's thought. And actually, just earlier today, I was doing a seminar with some of the students here, on Thomas's engagement with Greek patristic sources, which is very thoroughgoing and, you know, rather more profound than anything else that's going on in the West at the time. So Thomas is very much engaged in these Greek sources. And Florovsky appreciates that. And he regrets the oppositional narrative, which tends to write off Aquinas and the Western tradition in general. And says that for Orthodox theology to really be itself, it needs to engage constructively with Western theology, rather than just writing it off as just irredeemably rationalistic or whatever. So we need a dialogue. We need to talk to one another. And I think that's something that people in the East and West can definitely learn from. So Ferofsky is a bit of a hero of mine insofar as he does push back against this narrative of opposition. But sadly, that narrative of opposition between, you know, West versus East is still very much with us. I mean, there are figures who try and write against it, but it's still a prevailing narrative in Orthodox circles. And as I say, it has its counterpart in Catholic circles. But I want to contrast what we see in 20th century Orthodox theology with what was going on when the Orthodox were first reading Aquinas. And there we get a very different picture. So I mentioned some of the translations of Aquinas, which are made in the 14th century. So Aquinas is actually translated into Greek as early as, for example, 1354 is when we have the translation of the Summa Contra Gentiles, one of Thomas's major works, 1354. And in fact, the writer tells us that he finished it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the 24th of December, 1354, which is a pretty precise date. We're not usually quite so precise in our dates from the 14th century. Anyhow, 1354, Summa Contra Gentiles, Summa Theologiae gets translated too. And the person who's doing the translation, somebody called Demetrius Kizonis, who's actually prime minister of the Roman Empire, or Byzantine Empire. And he actually is sort of fed up with his translators. He thinks his translators aren't really doing justice to the language and his diplomacy with the Western powers. So he decides to learn Latin himself, and he finds a Dominican in Constantinople. There were Dominicans there from the 13th century onwards. And the Dominican says, well, how about this? And gives him Aquinas. And quite clever. The Dominicans have always been pretty clever. And anyway, so he gets him hooked on Aquinas. And before you know it, he's translating Aquinas into Greek. And he thinks this is a real treasure. But he doesn't see it as something other, something foreign. I mean, what he likes about Aquinas is Aquinas's mastery of Aristotle, of Greek philosophy. And in fact, he's able to slightly correct Aquinas's translations of Aristotle from the original. Because, of course, in the Eastern Empire, they never lost Aristotle. They never had to rediscover Aristotle, as they did in the Christian West, relying on material coming in from the Arabic world, before that, the Syriac world. Before that, the Greek world. But going through a sort of process in which a certain amount was lost in translation, as it were. So when Kithonius is translating Aquinas and he's got his quotes from Aristotle, he can sometimes correct them against the original Greek. Kind of quite helpful and rather good. But Kithonius recognizes the commonalities between Aquinas and Orthodoxy. His use of Aristotle, I mentioned to start with, but also his immersion in the Greek fathers. He recognized Thomas as somebody whose work was bathed in the light of the Greek fathers. So in other words, he's not, in making Aquinas known in the later Roman or Byzantine Empire, he's not bringing in some sort of foreign import, but recognizing Aquinas as one of us, as it were, as an honorary Greek, an honorary Hellene, an honorary Roman, because of course they called themselves Roman in the Roman Empire right down to 1453. In the Roman Empire of the East. And he laments the great prejudice and misunderstanding that's built up between Greeks and Latins at the time. Although the Latins at the time were emerging as the kind of preeminent mercantile and military power in the Western Mediterranean, at any rate, and the Byzantine Empire was shrinking, the Roman Empire was shrinking. Nonetheless, the Romans of Constantinople, the Romans of the ongoing Roman Empire centered on Constantinople down to 1453, tended to look down on the Latin world, just seeing them as soldiers or innkeepers or merchants. So a bit surprised, actually, at Aquinas, because how learned he was, how he knew Aristotle, he knew the Greek fathers and, of course, the Latin fathers. So Kithonius is very explicit that we should never let ourselves, you know, start thinking of East and West as different categories. We have a shared tradition here. So Aquinas is somebody who can help us. And actually, there was quite a vogue for Aquinas in the later years of the Roman Empire in the East, in the later Byzantine Empire. They translated Aquinas. They found him useful. They found him useful in dialogue with Islam in particular. So Kithonis himself, I have to say, was so impressed by Aquinas, he did end up converting to Roman Catholicism And for my purposes, that's a not the best thing that could have happened. But I think it came later in his life, and some of the material I was talking about comes earlier from his life when he's still recognizing this compatibility. But even when he converted, that doesn't mean he's rejecting orthodoxy, but coming back to that common foundation, a common faith centered on Rome. Another figure I'm going to talk about, you know, just two figures from the later Roman Empire, Gennadius Scholarios, first patriarch of Constantinople after the fall of the city of Constantinople to the Turks in 1453. And before that, the leader of the anti-unionist party in Byzantium, in the Roman Empire of the East. So the last years of the Roman Empire in the East, 13th, 14th, 15th century, dominated by this question of union. Should we reunite with Rome? And if we reunite with Rome, surely they're going to launch a crusade. They're going to come and rescue us from the Turks. Of course, the whole history of the Crusades is a problematic one, especially the Fourth Crusade, as far as the East is concerned, the one that took the city of Constantinople. Anyhow, the hope was that reunion with Rome would save the empire from the Turks. So there's a lot of discussion about reuniting with Rome. There are two big councils which meet, one in Lyons, 1274, Lyon, south of France, one in Florence in the 15th century, 1438-9. Both conclude a union, but that union doesn't last. So big debates about should we reunite to Rome? What's the cost? What cost should we pay? What price should we pay in order to have our city, Constantinople, saved from the Turks? And Gennadius Scholarios, this figure I'm talking about, who becomes the first patriarch of Constantinople after it falls to the Turks in 1453, he's the leader of the people opposing union. We must not unite with Rome. You know, we'll lose our faith by uniting with Rome, and we'll necessarily lose to the Turks too. Even the idea of military support from the West is illusory. You know, if we lose our faith, then we'll lose our city. Quite unambiguous about that. But you might be surprised to know that the leader of the anti-Rome, anti-unionist party in Byzantium at this time, when it's encircled by the Turks and desperate for help, declares himself to be Thomas Aquinas' most ardent disciple in either East or West. So for Scholarios, Thomas, okay, he's wrong on a couple of things. He's wrong on the papacy. He's wrong on the papal claims. He's also wrong in his account of the vision of God. But on all other matters, he's brilliant. And in fact, he's got a rather amusing comment in one of his manuscripts when he laments the fact that Aquinas was born in the West, not the East, because he thinks his defense of things like the papacy, filioque, a sort of an accident. You know, he had to do that. I mean, he didn't really have any choice because he's born in the Roman Catholic tradition. And he says, "Oh, Thomas, oh, most excellent Thomas, I wish you had not been born in the West. Then you wouldn't have had to justify the errors of that church about the papacy, about the filioque. Then you would have been as infallible in theological matters as you are in this treatise on ethics." It's a kind of marginal note to the Secunda Secundae, the second part of the second part of Thomas's Summa Theologiae. So really enthusiastic about Thomas. Yes, unfortunately, he's wrong, but that's just because he was born by the Tiber and not by the Bosphorus. It's an accident of birth. But apart from those matters which divide the Greeks from the Latins, perfect, wonderful. As I say, he calls himself Thomas's most devoted disciple in either East or West. And like Kithonis before him, he saw Thomas as one of us, somebody who was immersed in the same, first and foremost, in the same scripture, the same patristic tradition, the same philosophical tradition. So one of us. He calls him the most excellent expositor and interpreter of Christian theology in those matters in which his church accords with ours. So certainly no fundamental opposition between East and West. Yes, some theological disagreements, but what's more important is the shared faith, the shared scriptural foundation, the shared patristic tradition, the shared philosophical tradition. And this sense of the underlying Catholicity and harmony of East and West is a marked feature of Byzantine reception of Aquinas, and it also goes into the early modern period. As I say, it's only with the Slavophiles in the 19th century that this begins to change, and Orthodox theologians start operating almost instinctively within a narrative of West versus East. And I think they might have kind of needed to do that in the 20th century when you have Orthodox theologians shifted over from the Russian Empire after the Bolshevik Revolution into Western Europe. A lot of Catholics, a lot of Protestants weren't particularly interested in the Orthodox. You know, they had enough to talk about between themselves. So the Orthodox kind of had to shout very loudly about how different they were to kind of get noticed. But I really think we're past that stage. We need to move past this kind of oppositional theology, you know, East versus West. We need to get back, in other words, to the attitude of the Byzantines, for whom East and West were not opposites, for whom Greek and Latin-speaking Christianity were fundamentally united. Yes, they might differ on certain points, they might express their theological truths in a different language, but there's a fundamental congruity, a fundamental harmony, an underlying Catholicity between East and West. And that's the kind of attitude I want to get back to. So, you know, to finish off, West versus East, well, it's not a question. It shouldn't be a question just of West versus East, some sort of battle. We have to understand that East and West represent the same properly Catholic small c, properly Orthodox small o tradition. So West versus East, no, it should be East and West. We need each other. We need each other. Western Christianity, Eastern Christianity have been impoverished by the schism. We need each other. And if we simply write off the other or regard the other as kind of devoid of grace, then we'll get nowhere. And, you know, in a world where the pressures and challenges facing Christians today are so intense, I think it behooves all of us to do what we can to move ever closer to recognizing and manifesting the underlying Catholicity of East and West in everything we do, whether we're Western Christians or Eastern Christians. So that much on the West versus East. So it should be not either or a kind of battle, but recognizing the commonalities between East and West. So is Thomas Aquinas compatible with Orthodoxy? And related question, is Thomism compatible with Orthodoxy? Now, here I think, I don't know about if any of you are fans of Evelyn Waugh. Evelyn Waugh, Brideshead Revisited, Scoop, yeah, one or two people read it. He was a Catholic convert himself, and a bit of a snob, it has to be said. They used to say of Evelyn Waugh, he could speak to anyone, from royalty down to minor gentry. Anyway, even one of his best books, I think it's called Scoop. It's a kind of satire on journalism. And you have a newspaper magnate, you know, a newspaper owner, who's a very formidable character. He's called Lord Copper. And he has this underling called Sanders. And Sanders is so sort of terrified by Lord Copper that he can never disagree with him. So he only has kind of two answers. So if he wants to agree with Lord Copper, he'll say, yes, Lord Copper. Yes, Lord Copper. But he can't bring himself to say no, Lord Copper. So he says, up to a point. Up to a point, Lord Copper. So anyhow, is Thomas himself compatible with Orthodoxy? Yes, absolutely. Is Thomism compatible with Orthodoxy? Well, up to a point. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.